And Young, it's here and now. In a moment, our conversation with NPR's Sylvia Pagioli. But first, at noon East Coast time, from California to the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C., Americans mourned the victims of this week's massacre at Virginia Tech. The father of 19-year-old victim Mary Karen read a statement, in part saying, "We want the world to know and celebrate our children's lives." Well, Raja Mishra of the Boston Globe has been reporting on this story from Virginia for the Boston Globe. Raja, the governor of Virginia called for a moment of silence at noon today. You're in Centerville, where the shooter's family lived. Is this palpable where you are?
It absolutely is. There are cars with Virginia Tech slogans painted onto their rears, and you can see some of the restaurants and businesses have the maroon and orange ribbons on their doors and so on. So it's emanated far beyond Blacksburg.
Right. What about in Blacksburg, where the campus is? We know yesterday we heard that the university declared that students who want can take the rest of this year's term off. Was there any debate as to whether or not that was the correct thing to do, you know, to let them each go to their hometowns or to keep them together and get them back to work? Was there any debate over that?
I don't think there was any debate. I mean, the way the administration is approaching it is just sort of like on a case-by-case basis. So the students who want to come back and resume classes and take exams on Monday can do so, and others can have a phased reintroduction to classes. Others can opt out of them. So they're just sort of being extremely flexible about it, it sounds.
And the semester does end May 5th, so it's not very long. But what has happened? Can you tell? Are most students leaving?
Most students have left this week with classes closed, but the administration is telling us that, based on their email traffic from students, it seems like most, they think, are actually going to come back.
Where does the investigation stand?
Well, I mean, it's sort of the initial phase of it, the gathering the physical evidence and that sort of thing is sort of done. And what I think where it moves now is a sort of longer-term, larger-scale investigation commissioned by the governor, and in which Tom Ridge, the former Homeland Security Secretary, is going to be involved, and a couple other law enforcement, high-ranking law enforcement folks in Virginia. And that's going to look at sort of a more global thing, not just what happened there, but, you know, how far back were the signs, how did the mental health system function, how did the gun check system function. And that's really what we're waiting for, and that could actually be weeks.
Well, Raja, we know that you're working on a biographical piece about Cho Sung-hui in his town, as you said, right now, looking at a profile of the Korean-American community he grew up in. What are you learning?
The pattern that's emerging is, you know, we've heard about this sullen loner at Virginia Tech. Well, that apparently was predated his college career. So in high school, we're talking to former classmates and even middle school, in which you know, classmates are sort of saying the same thing, that he didn't speak at all, that he would behave kind of oddly in class, refusing to answer questions from teachers, and nobody really had a sense of him. But at that time, you know, it wasn't as menacing. He was just sort of the odd kid, you know, and people didn't seem to think that much more of him. But, I mean, we're trying to dig into his family history. You know, his family immigrated from Korea after struggling economically there.
In fact, you've learned that his family in Korea thought that Cho Sung-hui might have been mute?
He spoke so infrequently that they thought he might be mute. Yeah, he might have some kind of actual physical problem speaking. And, of course, that doesn't appear to turn out to be the case, but it sort of gives you a sense that, you know, these problems go way back into his adolescence.
I want to ask you one last question about Blacksburg and the Virginia Tech campus. We understand that students there are pretty tired of the media.
Yeah, and understandably so. I mean, the media contingent there was massive. I mean, it's just dozens and dozens and dozens of these large satellite trucks, and I would guess like 400 reporters at least, running around, all of us interviewing the same kids over and over, sort of everywhere. So I understand it. I mean, it's sort of at the beginning, maybe there's this desire to talk, but after a few days, it must be wearing on them. So I understand that sentiment.
And as much as the media been starting to leave, but there are signs, I understand, posted asking them to.
Yeah, I mean, it's the contingent is growing smaller. The university is going to stop holding regular press conferences, and the media contingent is going to be transferred to their sports complex, where they have more, space to handle them. But, I mean, it's going to be less. It's definitely less. I mean, I left today.
Raja Mishra of the Boston Globe, thanks so much.
No problem. My pleasure.
Well, according to the Associated Press, in the wake of the Virginia Tech shootings, world opinion of U.S. gun laws appears to be one of nearly unanimous condemnation. Here's a sampling of some European headlines. The French daily Le Monde calls the number of mass shootings in the U.S. a blotch on America's image. The main story in Italy's main daily newspaper was an opinion piece entitled Guns at the Supermarket, in which several Italian students at Virginia Tech told of barricading themselves inside a building near the shootings this week. Well, it's one of the jobs of our next guest to gauge European opinion. Sylvia Pagioli is NPR's senior European correspondent. She's in town to give a talk at Harvard. She's normally based in Rome, so we're thrilled to have you here, Sylvia, for Reporter's Notebook. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
And let's start with the Virginia story. What are you hearing from Europe on the shooting? And mass killings there aren't unheard of. And remember, in 2002, the German teenager licensed under Germany's strict gun laws shot and killed 12 people at a high school there. But what have you been hearing?
Well, I'll mention another headline that was in another Italian, a leftist paper, had the shootings are as American as apple pie. Mm. And I think that's sort of one of the underlying themes, this sense that this is something very typically American, despite the fact that there have been some isolated cases. There was one big case in Germany, as you mentioned, and then there was a case in Scotland a few years ago. But in both those cases, both countries passed extremely tough, even tougher laws that were existed before on gun ownership. And I think that's the thing that Europeans basically just do not understand, is this American obsession with guns.
Well, in fact, tell us, Italy's gun ownership laws, we understand there's three types, one for personal safety, one for target practice or skeet shooting and hunting. And police grant authorization for personal safety guns only to an adult with a valid reason. I mean, go ahead.
Well, for instance, in the case of somebody who's an owner of a jewelry shop, this kind of a thing. But it's very tough. I mean, there's a lot of controls. Mm-hmm. I don't know the exact rules in every country, but it's just simply much tougher. It's just rare to see a gun, mm-hmm. except, a policeman or a soldier or whatever. But, again, it's just that it's a totally different mentality. I think there's been, the sense in Europe is also, this is a continent that has had so much slaughter, so much disaster in the 20th century. That certainly there is a sense, there's a reverse feeling, there's
right.
a very pacifistic feeling. And so this American obsession with gun, it's seen almost as like a civil rights issue in a sense.
Yeah.
It's very analogous to the European lack of understanding of the death penalty in America. To be a member of the European Union, you cannot have the death penalty.
Hmm.
And as a matter of fact, even for European politicians who are campaigning, it's not uncommon for them to come visit death row inmates in the United States. Europeans know more about death row inmates by name than Americans do often.
Hmm.
So these are two issues that are just part of a tremendous disconnect between the United States and Europe over these kind of issues.
Well, Sylvia Pagioli, as we said, has covered so many issues, including the one she just spoke of, and she's going to spend a few minutes talking about them. By the way, if you have a question for her about any of the news, you can email us, and we'll try to get it in at letters@here-now.org. And Sylvia, you've covered, and we know because we checked, in the past year alone, let's start with the Pope celebrating his 80th birthday in the beginning of his papacy's second year. Let's listen.
Tens of thousands of people filled St. Peter's Square as the Pope celebrated his birthday a day early.
We so relied on you during this event. Just before we move on down the list, your assessment of the new Pope, not new anymore, but your assessment.
Well, I think in some respects, we don't know yet exactly. The former Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger was elected very much in the sense of guaranteeing a continuity with the papacy of John Paul II. In fact, he had been one of the prime architects also of the dogmatic of the dogma of John Paul II's papacy. And so he was seen as a assuring continuity. Some conservatives are, I think, reassured that he has is that way. And I think liberals are somewhat a little bit more dismayed. He hasn't made huge moves. Probably the most important thing he did was the most unexpected thing was his comments, very controversial comments about Islam last year in a speech when he was in Germany. And a lot of people attributed that to a lack of diplomacy, that it was a bit of a mistake. Others think that it was very much that it was he was very conscious of where he was going, that he wanted to draw a line between Christianity and Islam.
Well, let's remind ourselves, the Pope quoted a Byzantine Christian emperor who believed that Islam was evil and inhuman. And it reminds us that you are in Boston to talk at Harvard this evening about Muslims in Europe. And I'm just wondering, what is your overarching thought that you want to convey?
Well, I think, first of all, that the issue of immigration, which in Europe is code for Muslim immigration, is probably the most important issue in European societies today. There are something like an estimated, we don't know the exact numbers, but 15 to 20 million Muslims in the various European countries. And it was an issue that was for decades really ignored. But now, with certainly after the bombings of the, certainly after 9/11, when it turned out that several of the hijackers had actually been educated, been living in Europe. They came from Europe. Some people actually believe that their radicalization occurred in Europe. Mm-hmm. And the case of the Madrid bombings, the London bombings, certainly Europeans are very much alarmed by the situation. There's no question that the radical Muslims in Europe are a very, very small minority. But there is a tremendous misunderstanding, lack of knowledge, and a lot of it due to poor policies and lack of any effort on the part of European governments to try to integrate these communities over the last 20, 30 years.
We're also hearing, and you tell us what you know, that many of these communities don't want to integrate, that there's a sense that they, you're nodding your head yes.
This is absolutely true. There's also a phenomenon called self-ghettoization, and where you have, for instance, in Germany, which is a majority, the Muslims are from Turkish origin, you have what they call parallel societies, where completely, almost even more strict observance of Islam than you would find, let's say, in their towns of origin in Turkey or in Morocco or whatever, where there's almost like a congealed older type of Islam or older type of paternalistic societies. And there have been cases, several cases, both in Germany, there was a recent case in Italy, where imams have been heard preaching in the mosques, very, very radical and very basically appealing to Muslims not to integrate and to never have any kind of faith in the infidel the so-called the Christian or, anyways, host societies.
Well, if you've just tuned in, I know you recognize the voice. This is NPR Sylvia Bajoli, NPR senior correspondent in Europe, talking about a topic very much on her mind, Muslims in Europe. And, you know, we're coming up on a break, and when we come back, I want to ask you about reports, for instance, the New York Times reporting that more people in the political mainstream in Europe speaking up about how Islam maybe can't be reconciled with European values. I want to get your thoughts on the famous Italian journalist Oriana Fallaci, who died last year but weighed in very heavily on this topic. And then, you know, just ask you about you. Sylvia Pajoli, the name we all love to say. We'll be back with more from Sylvia right after a very quick one-minute break. Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back with NPR senior European correspondent Sylvia Pajoli, based in Rome but in Boston for the day to speak at Harvard. She's been with National Public Radio since 1982. She's covered the fall of communism in Eastern Europe, the first Persian Gulf War. She won a Peabody Award for her coverage of the Bosnian conflict, continues to report from all over Europe. And we were talking about her thoughts about Muslims in Europe. And I want to get right to the question about journalist Oriana Fallaci. Again, died last year, but her 2004 book was The Force of Reason, a bestseller in Europe. In it, she argues that Europe is under a Muslim siege and that peaceful coexistence with what she called Islamofascism is impossible. She warned that Europe is in danger of becoming Eurabia, a colony of Islam. What is the view of her opinion?
Well, first of all, I have to say that I think I never read her books. I did read one of the, I began to read one of the long articles that she first wrote that then turned into her book, and it was really, it was just so over the top that that it, you know, I couldn't even finish it. I mean, I think also what is too bad, because I had met her years ago, and I had admired her when I was young. She was, in a sense, a role model for many women journalists, mm-hmm. because she was one of the first out there, and she was a war correspondent. She was quite extraordinary. But I don't know, something happened to her, something cracked, and it was also strange because she was basically, she was living in the United States and not in Europe, not in Italy, so she probably went back several times, but I don't think that she really was experiencing it directly as she would have indicated in her books. I think unfortunately, you know, Europe right now is going through a sense of sort of the impact of globalization, rising unemployment, are producing a sense of insecurity and a loss of national identity. And of course, this is playing right into the hands of right-wing parties. There's a rise of xenophobic and nationalist slogans.
Resurgence of France's right-wing politicians.
Absolutely. And it's not just Le Pen is sort of the most obvious, and we've known about him for a long time. And yes, it was shocking in the last elections how well he did in the first round of the French elections, and it can't be ruled out that he might do well this time too. But it isn't just there. There's in Denmark, in other parts of Scandinavia, in Belgium, in the Flemish-speaking part of Belgium, there's really a growth of popularity of right-wing parties. And again, what is happening is that their popularity is forcing centrists and leftists to sort of move further a little bit closer to the right, and mm-hmm. everybody's embracing sort of political correctness is being kind of weakened. Language taboos are now being broken as the debate, you know, they're beginning to actually debate the limits of tolerance.
Well, where do you think it goes, Silvia Pajoli? You know, because as you said, as you yourself just said, there's a minority of this very, very perhaps violent Islamists in Europe, but there also are these growing neighborhoods, as you nod, yes, of, you know, congealed, very conservative neighborhoods of Muslims who don't want to integrate. On the other hand, you have some very violent talk from right-wing politicians. So where does it go?
Well, you know, again, remember, the big difference between Europe and the United States is that Europe starts as, these are mono-ethnic societies, and the whole issue of nationalism in the 19th century is how modern Europe was built. It is not a place of immigration. So European societies have had a great deal of difficulty, are still having difficulty in dealing with the fact of absorbing people from such a different culture, different religion. At the same point, it has to be pointed out that the big issue of the cartoons, the Danish cartoons about Mohammed, where there were all the riots and negative reaction in the Islamic world, and also to the remarks, the Pope's remarks on Islam, which I mentioned before, there were none of these demonstrations among Muslims in Europe. And this is a big dividing line. And also polls have shown recently that with some exceptions, for instance, in France, the Muslims in France want to be consider themselves French before they consider themselves Muslim. The whole problem here is where the moderate Islamic, the modern Muslims are, and why they're so quiet and why they're not so more forceful in coming out and demonstrating. And this is a big problem because they still are very much in fear of those small, very small numbers of radical Muslims. And so this is, I think, they need much more encouragement also from the host societies, moderate Muslims, to come out and to feel part of their societies.
Right. Silvia Pajoli, obviously NPR senior correspondent, talking about her thoughts about Muslims in Europe. But in the few minutes we have, I want to ask you a quick question, because you were an award-winning war correspondent as well, particularly your coverage of the conflict in Bosnia. As you look at Iraq and the sectarian violence there, you just made a face, sort of a uy. What do you see ahead? You know, carnage and sectarian violence and deep bloodbath no matter what happens? Or is it possible to bring the sects together?
Well, you know, the Balkans, the fighting is long stopped. There's no question about that. But they're, you know, despite what the diplomats will tell you, a place like Bosnia, it's still very divided. The war Dayton Agreement put an end to the fighting. It did not put the multi-ethnic society back together again. And again, the multi-ethnic society existed in the cities. It didn't exist out in the rural areas. But still, you go there today and you'll see separate sections. So I'm skeptical. I'm extremely highly skeptical that multi-ethnic coexistence can return to the Balkans. For what little I know, I have not covered Iraq. That's not my area. I would say it's even more difficult there.
Yeah. Well, gee, we've hardly had time to get to your story about the opera star that was booed off the stage, or the Italian prime minister having to publicly apologize to his wife for flirting with other women. And there was the, tasting olives, olive oil, picking olives. Just in the minute and a half that we have, how much do you love your work?
Oh, I love it. I love it especially because, we learn so much doing this job. That's really what it is, a constant learning experience. And sometimes we do some lighter stories, and that's also real tremendous fun. The olive tasting was great, great fun. I learned an awful lot about olive oil. The Berlusconi stories are really fluff and not so interesting, but...
Sometimes between the tough assignments. Silvia Pagioli, do people come up to you and ask you to say your name?
In the U.S., yes.
Yes, they do. Well, we're going to hear it now. We want to leave our listeners before we take a quick break with some of your reporting. Silvia Pagioli, NPR's senior news correspondent, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
It was my pleasure.
And as we take a quick break, we'll be back with much more Here and Now, but here are those words we love to hear.
And like in wine tasting, we're not supposed to swallow the oil. Cittadini slurps it up, squishes it around in her mouth, and then spits it back into her cup. She says olive oil tastings are never elegant. As Thomas Jefferson wrote, the olive tree is surely the richest gift of heaven. Silvia Pagioli, NPR News.
Sovin Young, it's Here and Now. Hospitals don't usually admit mistakes openly, and rarely do they make public apologies. But that's exactly what Beth Israel Deaconess Hospital in Boston did after the tragic loss of a baby in childbirth. And now that hospital is being recognized for changes it's made in the field of childbirth. The case dates back to 2000, when a healthy 38-year-old woman was admitted to give birth to her first baby. But the delivery ended with the baby dying, the woman's uterus rupturing, and an emergency hysterectomy. The case changed the way Beth Israel, one of the premier birthing hospitals in New England, provides patient care, and it's now a model for hospitals around the country. For more, we're joined by Dr. Ben Sachs, Chief of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Beth Israel Deaconess. Welcome.
Thank you.
Barbara Stabile joins us as well. She's nurse manager at Beth Israel. Barbara, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And Dr. Sachs, I want to start with you because you wrote about this incident in the Journal of the American Medical Association. You said the case shook the gynecology obstetrics department to its core.
I think that the department has always had a great deal of pride in the way that we provide care and always held out that we provide great care. So when this case occurred, people really couldn't understand how it could have happened at our hospital. But I think the difference was that we had an open discussion about what actually happened, that once we had made the apology and there had been a settlement with the family, that we could now have an open discussion. And so when we really dived into the issues, people said, wow, that's really amazing. How could that have happened?
Right.
And we really need to change things.
And we should say you've just received a $100,000 prize from Blue Cross Blue Shield, sort of an excellence award, and you're going to use that money to train obstetric nurses in patient safety. We want to learn about the steps that you learned, but first tell us, what did go wrong?
What happened that night, it was extremely busy. There were a lot of very sick patients on our labor and delivery, and this particular patient wasn't considered to be high risk. So she didn't get the attention that she should have had, and by the time it was realized there was something going wrong, it was already a little bit too late.
What was going wrong?
That her uterus was rupturing. And it meant that the oxygen supply would be taken away, that the placenta, the afterbirth, would be detached from the wall of the uterus, and therefore the baby could not survive. Mm-hmm. So I think that people recognized at the time that the final rupture occurred that things were really catastrophic, but there was a time or window before then that actions could have been taken, not to prevent it happening, because this is a rare event in of itself, but could have intervened earlier so that she may not have lost the child.
Right. Barbara, you're nodding yes. By the way, were you at all involved?
I was actually there the following morning when I came in. The patient was in the operating room.
Right.
And I did spend the morning with the husband. It was one of the hardest things I think I've ever done as a nurse because she was a very healthy woman. This was very unexpected.
Well, as you mentioned, Dr. Sachs, you reached a financial settlement without a lawsuit. You didn't have to go public.
I believe that the public knows that there are mistakes made in hospitals. I think we need to be more open with the public, and that openness allows us to heal internally when there's a bad outcome that could have been avoided, and also to implement changes that could really make a difference.
Did you get input from the public?
From the family. We have a grand rounds every year, which is a lecture which is held in honor of the child who didn't survive. And we invite the family to come once a year. They come, and they come with their friends and family, and it reminds us of the journey we've been on for the last 7 years.
That's remarkable, because I would think that would be so painful for that family to do.
Well, it's painful for them, and it's also very uncomfortable for the staff. But over the years, I think we've all come to appreciate what we've learned from each other.
Well, what have been the improvements? You noted 6 system failures that led to the baby's death. What were those problems?
Miscommunications. The fact that labor and delivery was extremely busy and the right resources weren't in the right place at the right time. People weren't aware of what was going on. Some lab tests may not have been looked at in a timely basis. All of those kind of things were going wrong.
Some of the other issues, we understand the attending physician had been on call for 21 hours.
I think it's a real problem. You know, when I grew up in the field of obstetrics, I would take call the whole weekend. And by the end of the weekend, you'd be exhausted. Science has shown us that if I'm up for 24 hours, my reaction time is worse than somebody who's legally drunk in Massachusetts and shouldn't be driving a car. We have physicians who are working for 24-hour shifts, and it's really a problem.
It's still happening.
It's still happening. It's still happening in our department. Although a fair number of our docs have migrated to working 12-hour shifts, it turns out to be extremely difficult for some people to do 12-hour instead of 24-hour shifts.
Well, you've now adapted training techniques used by the U.S. military to improve your quality of care. What changes did you make? Tell us what the adaptations were.
I think it's actually, I would describe it as a, not just change, I think it's a revolutionary, different approach, and it's used by commercial aviation and used by the U.S. military. And it's called crew resource management or team training, where you are really getting people to work as teams together. So you have nurses and physicians of different types, obstetricians, anesthesiologists, and pediatricians, all helping each other at the same time. Now, for the public, that may sound like a logical thing that everybody does that. Why do you need this new kind of programs? But we're so used to working in silos in our own field. The anesthesiologist may not be aware of all the thinking going on in the obstetrician's mind, or the pediatrician may not be aware that this woman who's about to deliver is carrying a baby that has a heart defect, for example. Has there been enough communication on a timely basis so the pediatrician has a delivery room set up to take care of a newborn infant that's got a heart problem?
Barbara, how do you see that affecting the unit now as opposed to then?
Well, one thing that we do is we have a team meeting with all of the players involved at the board, and we review all the patients on the board.
What the big board that we see in the television shows of all the patients on the floor.
What each patient's plan of care is, what their fetal monitor tracing looks like, and what the workload is of that physician and that nurse. And that is done a number of times a shift.
So you can see automatically if a doctor's overloaded or if a nurse is overloaded.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Sachs, one would think that after the publicity that you got for the because of the death of an infant, that this hospital, which is quite esteemed, would lose patients. I'm wondering what has happened.
Well, actually, there was a great deal of anxiety as to how the public would respond. In fact, the opposite happened. People were calling to transfer their care to the Beth Israel Deaconess, because I think the public realizes that there are events going on in the hospital, and we were being honest about it. We were saying we weren't perfect, but we were trying to correct things. So, in fact, we've had the opposite reaction from the public, and it's been very gratifying to go through this.
Dr. Ben Sachs, Chief of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Beth Israel Deaconess Hospital here in Boston, speaking about how the loss of a child during labor, that tragedy led the hospital to change the way it delivers babies. We've also been speaking with Barbara Stabile. She's nurse manager of labor and delivery at Beth Israel. Thank you both so much for coming in and speaking to us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, Well, still to come before we go today, if you knew your father had been a high-ranking official in Hitler's Nazi party, how could you believe he didn't know what happened at Auschwitz? A new film explores that question. That's still coming up. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, now some of your thoughts. After we spoke yesterday with activist Mia Farrow about the crisis in Darfur, we heard from more than one of you angry that she compared supporters of China to supporters of Nazi Germany because of China's support of the genocidal government in Sudan and China's purchase of Sudan's oil. Well, Eric Chan of Sound Beach, New York, had an additional thought. If the Chinese people do not receive enough oil, he writes, then their economy might come to a halt and far more people would suffer as a result. Well, most of you wrote this week about the shootings at Virginia Tech. Rob Hopps from Worcester, Massachusetts, took issue with the media's coverage of that issue.
My thought is that these horrendous killings are happening every day in Iraq, and yet we get a discernible difference in media coverage of what happens here versus what happens there.
But Bob Brodsky thanked us for our stories about what schools are doing to protect students, and he added, I live in Rowley, Massachusetts, where we have a few telephone poles with sirens atop to warn us if the Seabrook nuclear power plant blows. On routine tests, the sirens can be heard 2 miles out to sea. Other colleges could economically use such sirens to tell students when to take cover. And Katie Murphy of Boston, Massachusetts writes, well, it makes sense to track kids who exhibit disturbing behavior. Tracking kids who simply have mental illnesses is grossly invasive. My brother has bipolar disorder, and I can't imagine if he had to communicate with people on campus who were trying to determine his threat level. I think it's very important that conversations on the topic of the Virginia Tech shootings do not irresponsibly link mental illness and violence. And Adira Zwelling, a graduate of Virginia Tech, had this thought. I live in Portland, Oregon now, where people rarely knew Virginia Tech existed, and I found myself feeling compelled to wear my Virginia Tech T-shirt, and now find myself talking with strangers, conversations prompted largely by my T-shirt. I realize that in order to process something so upsetting as this, one needs a sense of community. Actions like this are too hard to process all alone. Well, her thoughts prompted some from me, if you don't mind. There were many of us this week who know, first of all, that those kids cowering under desks could have been kids we love. But the shooter could have been someone we loved as well. I know statistics show that the mentally ill are far more likely to harm themselves, but even so. Our family member was a bright, beautiful 20-something who suddenly began snarling at enemies seen only by him. He also was sent home with a diagnosis and a prescription, but come to find out, young people fueled by raging hormones fanning their illness don't always want to take the drugs that can save their lives, but to them feel mind-numbing. What followed was an epic battle, pleading with him to accept his illness when he was in the hospital, driving the streets and working the phones to try to find him when he was out. Along the way, making friends with emergency room workers, police dispatchers, learning about Section 12, that's the directive from a hospital that allows a person to be restrained, bonding with a team of police here in Boston, especially trained to work with the mentally ill. Once my loved one was at the prestigious McLean Hospital here in Belmont, Massachusetts. They called to say he was going to be moved from a locked ward to an on-campus house. Oh, no, he's not ready, I said. And sure enough, the next call was that he'd up and left. Did you call the police, I asked? Did you take out a Section 12? Oh, yes, they said. So I began the drill, told the police to go to a construction site where I knew he'd pick up a check. They called me back. We're here. He's here, they said. But there's no Section 12 in the computer, so we had to let him go. I called back McLean. I thought you took out a Section 12, I said. I did, the caretaker said triumphantly, in Belmont. Well, the computer's in Belmont. Don't talk to the computers in Boston, a couple miles away. This week, we did several stories on how systems, police systems, university hospital systems, don't talk to each other. And we received an email from Jeffrey Clare in North Carolina who said, you're trying to blame everyone but the criminal. Maybe so, maybe so. But my loved one is now doing great. In fact, he's become kind of an advocate for mental health care. And when I think of the safety net, as porous as it was, that he had, trained police teams, steadfast health workers, fiercely vigilant family and friends, I can't help but wonder, How could a young man in Virginia, seemingly just sent off with a diagnosis, navigate these dangerous shoals alone? Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
Mut, Beharrlichkeit, Gefolgschaft, Treue und Opferbereitschaft.
That's the voice of Hans Ludin giving a speech in which he extols the virtues of the SA, the Nazi stormtroopers. In 1947, Hans Ludin, a longtime member of Hitler's Nazi Party, as well as Hitler's ambassador to Slovakia, was hanged as a war criminal.
Muss dieses Ziel erreicht werden. Diesem Ziel zu dienen, sei unsere Ehre.
Imagine if that sound was in your family's home movie collection. Hans Ludin was German filmmaker Malte Ludin's father. He was executed when Malte was only 5, but decades later, Hans Ludin's legacy looms large over his family. When Malte's mother died, he decided to confront the past, to open the wooden trunk that he called the Trunk of Sorrows, where packed away was Nazi correspondence, movies, and pictures, to ask the question, did his father know that the Jews that were deported from Slovakia were murdered in the camps they were sent to? Malte's film is the German language Two or Three Things I Know About Him, and Malte Ludin joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you. Welcome.
Also joining us is the film's producer and Malte's wife, Eva Schwartz. Welcome to you as well.
Hello.
And I want to ask you first, we understand you say at one point in your film that your wife, then someone, a woman you just met, helped provoke the questions that came. Why?
Because she is from Czechoslovakia, and Czechoslovakia was suffering the German occupation during the Nazi dictatorship, and so she had totally different approaches to this subject.
Eva, you're from a Jewish Christian background. Did you
yes.
lose someone in the Holocaust?
Not directly, no. Yeah.
What kinds of things did you ask him that helped him ask questions?
When I met his mother, so the first thing what his mother told me was, Hans Ludin loved the Slovaks. So
he loved the Slovaks.
So I was asking, which Slovaks? The fascists one? Because obviously he didn't love the Jewish ones. So I think it was the first time that somebody was questioning that in the family.
I think somebody
must come from outside to put these questions on, because the entire family was following the legacy of the mother. And the mother always said to them, he was a nice guy, he helped the Slovak, and he hasn't done anything wrong.
So this sounds impossible, you know, to people from mm-hmm. outside of Germany. But are you saying that until you were, a young adult and met your future wife, you'd never really questioned what your dad did?
No, I was a part of the family, and I was part of the German society, and nobody in the German society, except some exceptions, did ask questions about the parents.
In Germany, you know, the Nazis in the German society are always the other ones, you know, not part of the family members.
Yeah.
Every family has a Nazi in the family, but they are always the other ones.
Well, in this case, you find out that your father was not just a Nazi. He was a very high-ranking Nazi. And the Pandora's box opens. After your mother dies, this is the box where they were putting comforters, but also you find she was putting all of the Nazi memorabilia about your dad. And it unleashes the questioning of your siblings. We meet several of your still surviving siblings. It's painful to watch your sisters almost squirm in front of your camera, because they don't want to let go of the myth. What was that like for you to watch that?
I knew it from different occasions before, when we had arguments about the role of my father. But in this absolutely brutal way, I didn't know it before. And it was painful for me. It was painful for them as well.
Well, let's listen to a little of that happening on screen right in front of us. This is a scene where your sister, one of the two that we meet, they both have wonderful memories of your father, how handsome he was in his uniform. And in this point, you're really pushing her a little bit, and she's talking not only about your father, but about the Jews, and saying that it was only one-third of the Jews who went to the camps, the ones that went with the lower class, just a whole series of rationalizations. Let's listen.
I said to her, does it make any difference what part of Jews were hit by the German persecution?
So what happened? Did you find evidence that your father knew that the Jews he was deporting were being killed?
No, I have no evidence about it, but it doesn't matter for me, because this whole regime of Hitler was criminal. Yeah? Mm-hmm. It doesn't begin with the deportation and the killing of the Jews. It began very early. It began even before Hitler came to power.
Mm. Your sister, Barbel, we didn't want to be a part of your film at all, but she said she did it because she felt someone should speak for her father. At one point, you juxtapose her wonderful memories of their big, beautiful home in Slovakia with people you met whose parents were deported, who lost their homes, Jews who had to sleep in barns. Did you ever feel that was too much, that, you know, this is your sister, unaware that people were sleeping with cows because she had this beautiful home?
Yeah, but the reality was that, and I tried to put the reality in the movie. The reality for my sister was totally different from the people who was persecuted in this time, and that's why I put it in the movie, and I did edit it. Mm. As a documentarist has to do it in a very opposite or in a very sharp way.
And how did you feel going to meet these people whose, you know, parents had been killed, perhaps because of your father, at the very least because of the party that your father was a member of, but maybe even by his own order? You don't know. How did you feel approaching them? I mean, they just seemed awfully nice to you.
It was, in part, it was shaming for me. I felt scared.
You were scared.
Yeah, it wasn't the behavior of the victims or the survivors what I met. It was my own position in this story, in this drama. Mm. For example, Mr. Stern, who was in the neighborhood of my father, he was hidden in this trunk, and he was very friendly to me. He said, "You aren't responsible for what your father did." But I couldn't stand it. Yeah.
You feel you are?
Not in a way as you are using the word responsibility, but in a way, yes. Yeah. Huh. My name is the same, and I'm the son of my father, so it's my destiny. Let's say that.
I think it's very difficult for my husband to explain it, but I think he felt the responsibility to face the truth and to speak with the people. And he was invited on his birthday to the Jewish community of Bratislava, celebrating with them. And it was a great pleasure to being there. And he was invited on Yom HaShoah, which is a Jewish Holocaust Memorial Day, to Bratislava, showing his film together with the Holocaust survivors of Bratislava. And it was very, very moving. And they said to Malte Ludin, your name, the name Ludin, is becoming now a better sound in Slovakia.
Hmm. Malte Ludin is the director, and Eva Schwartz is the producer of the film, Two or Three Things I Know About Him, him being Malte's father, Hans, a high-ranking Nazi officer. It's distributed by the National Center for Jewish Film at Brandeis University. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. Malte and Eva, thank you both so much for coming in and speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a good weekend. Spring is finally coming to some parts of the country. Please join us again here and now.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.